The Making Of is sponsored by Missoma.
Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Missoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Missoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Missoma.com.
Welcome to The Making Of, a podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. The highs, the lows, the life lessons, but I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the writer and campaigner, Bryony Gordon.
I remember the councillor saying, the thing is, shame dies when you expose it to the light, and it does.
As well as writing a weekly column for The Telegraph, Bryony is a prolific author, writing 6 books in the last 7 years. Her memoirs are funny and painful explorations of mental health and addiction, and her most recent book, No Such Thing as Normal, is a practical guide for those struggling to cope. Bryony is a passionate mental health campaigner, and in 2016, she founded Mental Health Mates, which is a network of peer support groups. And in 2017, she started her Mad World podcast, where Prince Harry chose to give his first interview about his own mental health problems. In our conversation, we talked about addiction, motherhood, mental health, and why it's good to choose slightly dull guys. So, here we go.
Bryony Gordon, welcome to the Female Lead podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are going to be talking about the 6 moments that have made you, not the very only 6 moments, but 6 moments that have made you, chosen by you.
Some of them have broken me, as some of them broke me too.
Shall we start off with moment one?
Mm-hmm.
Which is being told I was beautiful by my mum as a little girl.
My memories of my childhood were my mum, bless her. Like, she meant well, but it was always, oh, you're beautiful, you're, you know, like most women of her generation, I suppose, focused, like, the biggest compliment you could give a little girl was how pretty she was, or do you know what I mean? And I grew up then thinking that that was where my value was found. And I remember that moment where, and I still now, as a grown-up, have that kind of, when I see someone and they look lovely, because some people do and it's nice to tell them, but I have to correct myself and say, you are lovely. Not you look lovely, but you are lovely. So when my daughter, who is 7, I try not to ask her how I look. I try to tell her, you are gorgeous. You are, you know, as opposed to, it's about kind of more of a whole as opposed to surface. Because I think it's really important, and I don't blame my mother at all, and I think all parents did this. So I also don't think that I was like a stunning beauty as a child, so I really want to make that clear. But it did kind of stick in my head. You know, it's only now at the age of 40 I've really unpicked body image and how much of a hindrance it's actually been to me. You know, in my 20s I was bulimic and I was obsessed with my weight, and in my 30s I sort of became obsessed with not being obsessed with my weight, if that makes sense. And I got pregnant, and guess what? I put on loads of weight. And I, as a vaguely high profile columnist on a newspaper, people mentioned it all the time. Like, people I didn't know, they would write and go, you've put on weight. And it became a real point for me to make the point that I'm not less of a person. Well, obviously I'm more, but you know what I mean? Like, my character hasn't changed. You know, my value as a human being hasn't changed because I put on weight. And my value as a human being won't change if I lose it either. You know, my value as a human being doesn't change if I get a few more wrinkles. That's really important to me. And it's why I ended up running a marathon in my underwear, you know, at the age of 38, you know, and at the weight of 15 and a half stone, or I can't even remember what it was at the time, you know, to show that this was possible. Do you know what I mean? You could do all sorts of things, you know, and I still think it's so important. You know, I got up this morning and I ran 5 miles, you know, with my best, one of my best friends who has secondary breast cancer, you know. And for us, we don't run to be fast. We run to slow down. Does that make sense?
Yes,
to kind of like
completely.
To kind of stop and kind of get some perspective on our lives. And so I've had to re-narrate my whole kind of existence and what it means so that I don't sort of hit myself over the head because I'm not a size 10 and I, you know, I don't have amazing cheekbones. I mean, it was like, I remember my mum used to go, you've got amazing cheekbones. And I remember at some point learning, I'm like, everyone has amazing cheekbones, because if we didn't have cheekbones, our faces would literally be just like collapsed on the floor. Do you know what I mean? And then I saw an advert a couple of years ago on Instagram, and it was for a quite a well-known brand of face mask, and they had like customer testimonials. And someone, one of the customer testimonials was that, you know, before I used this, I had pores. And after I used it, I didn't. And I'm like, no, 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 babes, you have pores. If you didn't have pores, you would be dead. If you didn't have pores, you would have, like, swollen up because your skin wouldn't be able to regulate its temperature and you would die. Like,
you'd be like a ball of sebum walking around.
Exactly. That's a really important thing to me. So that's why I put that moment in there. You know, and I'm having to untangle it quite a bit. I've written this new book. It's called No Such Thing as Normal. And it's all the things I've learned about being mentally well from being mentally ill. And it was while writing the book that I realised that this year during lockdown, I'd really, like, I thought because I didn't purge food anymore, so I wasn't bulimic, I was fine. But in lockdown, I really been, like, food became like a real comfort for me. And I had to really unpack that. So I'm doing just some weekly treatment now with someone with an eating disorders specialist to kind of really recalibrate my relationship with food and how there isn't good food or bad food. And if I binge, I'm not the worst person in the world. And there's, you know, and it's like, eat to look after yourself. Do you know what I mean? Don't eat to punish yourself, or don't restrict eating. You know, for me, restriction and binging are two sides of the same coin, basically.
Me too. I mean, so much.
But it's amazing, isn't it, that it's taken me till basically 40 years old to learn that it's okay to have two portions of carbohydrates for breakfast.
And this those woman, are the best breakfast.
Like, my therapist, she's like, Bridie, you should have two pieces of... She said you should really, as an average woman, be having three portions of carbohydrates, so like three pieces of toast for breakfast. And I was like, what?
Just going back to the moment, that's so, it's just, that really strikes a chord with me. And I think with so many women, the way that your mum and other people would just always talk about your appearance as soon as they see you, that kind of, oh, you look pretty, or you look like that, or something. And then you just get this sense that your appearance is so important.
Yeah,
like more important than anything.
I find it's much easier to live when you're not caring what people think of the way you look or of the way you are. You know, that's the next level. That's like Jedi work, is not caring what people think of you, like, as a person. Do you know what I mean? Like, I am at the stage where I don't care what people think about the way I look. I just don't give a shit. Like, that's their shit, not mine. But, you know, like, it's going to take a bit more work before I reach the kind of, like, the Obi-Wan Kenobi level of, like, and I don't give a what you think about me as a person either. I'm like, not quite there yet,
but we're just, you know, like walking down the street like this, just like, yes,
yeah. I'm more like, I don't know what level of Jedi Knight I am.
Let's move on to moment two, which is reading about OCD in a newspaper at the age of 17. So what happened in this moment?
So I wanted to put this one in there because I have had obsessive compulsive disorder since I was about 11 or 12. But I didn't know it was obsessive compulsive disorder. I just thought it was, I didn't know what obsessive compulsive disorder was. And what I knew was that my brain was telling me the whole time that I was dying, or that someone was coming to get me. You know, my brain would tell me that I had AIDS, or I was going to give it to my family. Or then when I was 17, it started to tell me that I might have, like, killed someone and blanked out in horror on my like way back from school. And I got to the stage where I couldn't really leave the house. I just thought I was a terrible person. And then I remember, it must have been when I was 17, there was a film out called As Good As It Gets, starring Jack Nicholson. Yes. And he played someone with OCD in it. But it was a very, at the time, it was a very, the very stereotypical view of OCD. You know, he was very organised, tidy, whatever. But he won an Oscar for it. And I remember he, when he went to pick up the Oscar, he like skipped the steps to go up, you know, onto the platform. And but anyway, I remember my, we always had all the papers in my house when I was a kid. And I remember I reading The Guardian, and in The Guardian, and I wish I knew who'd written this piece, because I go and like find them and thank them. They'd done a piece about, oh, OCD is, you know, the subject of this new Hollywood movie, but it isn't just what you think it is. It's not just the kind of organisation and cleanliness thing. And then they'd, so I sort of was in, reading in it about it, and it, and then they mentioned this type called Pure O, where it could be about thoughts. So lots of people with it actually thought they were like serial killing paedophiles. It was like, so you describe OCD, I describe OCD now, as your brain refusing to acknowledge what your eye can see. So be it that your hands are clean, or that the oven's off, the hair straighteners are off, it's, you basically attach too much importance to the thought. So we all have those thoughts of, what if I just jumped in front of the train, or someone's handing my, me their baby, what if I was to drop the baby? Most of us dismiss the thoughts because we know that they're just random thoughts. Like, we all have thousands and thousands of thoughts a day. We are not our thoughts. But someone with this type of OCD will become very distressed by the thoughts, and then they will ruminate to prove they're not their thoughts. Anyway, so I read this thing and it was like, oh my God, that's what's wrong with me. That's what's wrong with me. And I remember cutting it out and like leaving it for my mum to see. And the reason I mention this, because it was not the moment that I got, you know, immediately better, but it's why I think it, as a journalist and a writer all these years later, I keep writing about this stuff, the stuff of experience. You know, people are like, oh, you know, another book about alcoholism, or, you know, a book about OCD now, you know, what is it next, Bryony? But these are just things I've experienced, and we have to talk about them, right? Because all mental illnesses, they thrive in a culture of silence. They lie to you. They tell you that you're a freak. They tell you that you're alone. They tell you that no one's going to understand what you're going through. And that is, to put it bluntly, bull. Not only does someone understand what you're going through, there's someone out there who's going through what you're going through right now. So, you know, to be able to pierce that kind of lie that you're told by mental illness in a voice that's completely indistinguishable from your own, by the way. So, but in order to pierce that, you need to meet and hear from other people that have the same things as you. And so when I first wrote about my OCD many years later, it was like I needed to, I was desperate to meet other people like me. And it was like my way of saying, okay, if you're out there, please come and talk to me, you know, let me know I'm not mad, or I am mad, but I'm not bad, you know. And it was, that was the start of my career as I know it now. My mum eventually read it and she took me to the doctor because of it. And it's been a long and complicated journey to recovery, but that is such an important thing, I think.
And, you know, you are now an advocate for talking about mental health, and you've written about it loads. And then you started Mental Health Mates. And for anyone that doesn't know, can you explain what that is? Because that's connected to this, isn't it? It's about feeling you're not alone.
Yeah, it's basically walks for people with mental health issues where they can walk and talk with each other without fear of judgment. Like, if we know that 1 in 4 people every year will experience a mental health issue, and we know that one of the best ways to help is sort of exercise and getting out of our own heads, you know. One of the symptoms of mental illness is that it traps you in your head, right? So I wanted to create something that sort of bridged that gap in a tiny way. And it's now all over the country, and you can go on the website, it's mentalhealthmates.co.uk, and it's to see if there's a walk in your area. And if it's, there's not, you can set one up yourself, and there's all the information there. So it's about creating peer support for people. And I, you know, I have very little to do with it now. It's amazing walk leaders who, you know, who do it because they want to create their own communities.
It's an incredible thing to have started. And, you know, with all the work that you do around this, what is the big change that you would like to see in society around mental health?
I want mental health for what to do when you're in a mental health crisis to be like stitched into our DNA, into the fabric of our society, in the way, mixed a few metaphors there, in the same way that we all know what to do if we break our arm or if our kid has a fever for a few days. You know, we go to A&E, we go to the doctor, and you know, obviously it's all changed a bit with COVID, but we're born knowing what to do. Do you know what I mean? And it's just, that's not the same with mental health issues. We don't know what to do. It's not quite as easily quantifiable. So the centre of this book is a huge chapter on how to ask for help and what's available to you, because all we hear about is how bad mental health provision is. That, if you're in crisis, isn't actually that helpful. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, okay, so, but there is provision out there, and the more that we ask for it, the more they have to provide it, if you see what I mean.
And the title in itself is helpful, I think. In fact, were you drawing on the Morrissey lyric, "There is no such thing as normal"?
No, absolutely not. No, I don't think I've never consciously listened to a Morrissey song in my life.
Probably best not to now. He's on the bad list.
I don't know. I don't know enough about him. Just that he's a bit miserable looking. Like, he's just a bit miserable. And I'm just not, to be honest, I'm just not cool enough. Like, when my friends were growing up, they were like, "Oh, I love Nirvana." And I was like, "I love Take That and New Kids on the Block." Never been cool in my life. So, no, I didn't know it was a Morrissey lyric.
It is, it's a really, I mean, you're not supposed to like him, but it's a good song. Anyway, but I just think that that's something that we all need to just kind of get on board with to remove stigma.
Well, this is, okay, so this is the thing I'd say to everyone. The one thing I want everyone to know is that every time you go to your GP and ask for help, you are being like a legend. You are being a mental health advocate, because you are holding the powers that be accountable. You're letting yourself be known. And so I think a lot of us think, "Oh, there's nothing I can do. I don't have a platform." That's bullshit. Like, every time you go and you speak out loud that there is something wrong, you are helping people. You are all mental health advocates. You are all mental health campaigners. Go out there, be loud, be proud. Yeah.
I love it. That's really good. Let's move on to moment three, which is discovering cocaine in your early 20s. I'm really fascinated to hear this one. Was there like a landmark moment where you like took it for the first time, or
the moment? I mean, I don't mean that in like, it's a great thing. So because I didn't have proper treatment for my OCD, I had no kind of coping mechanisms for it. And when you don't have any coping mechanisms for it, you find bad, when you don't have any good coping mechanisms, you find bad coping mechanisms. And the bad coping mechanism I discovered was alcohol and drugs. And they, for me, were the way I self-medicated, basically. So I could numb out for a period of time. And of course, it was often worse the next day, but the next day didn't matter to me because I was in so much pain right now. You know, I just needed to deal with now. And so I wanted to mention that because, like, I think it's just a nasty drug and it gets people into some really shameful, seedy situations, myself included. And I also think it's a lot more prevalent than people think it is. I think, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was very kind of celebrity-ish, whatever, dinner party, you know, posh people. But I think it's a drug that goes hand in hand with binge drinking. You know, I suppose my primary addiction is alcohol. But I want to speak about cocaine because I think a lot of people take it because it enables you to drink more. It kind of sobers you up a bit. But it also does all sorts of other things to you. And I have decades worth of shame attached to some of the things that happened to me or that I did when I was high. And also, it didn't solve any of my problems. It just gave me way more, you know. Mm. And so I just wanted to put that one in there, really, because in case anyone's listening, and a lot of people don't like talking about it. People don't like talking about alcoholism and addiction at the best of times, do you know what I mean? So. Mm. But I remember taking it and it was like I put on a fabulous dress. Yeah. But towards the end, it was like, it was just horrible. Like, it's just disgusting. It's horrible. And the feeling the next day is just appalling. And I think we need to talk about it because you are, I don't know what the exact statistic is, but you are far more likely to die by suicide if you have taken cocaine with alcohol.
Really?
Yeah.
And when you look back at that point and then see how that shaped you.
Well, it was the route I had to take, you know, there's no point in me going, I wish this hadn't happened or that hadn't happened. But like, all I know is that right now I'm so relieved. I don't take drugs or drink anymore, you know, and haven't for some time.
Yeah.
So, and in a way I'm grateful to cocaine in a bit because it took me in to sobriety a lot quicker. And I think that if I hadn't discovered it, I could have been out there in this sort of Groundhog Day of hangovers, but it got so bad because of the drug. The experiences were so sordid that I had to take action quicker. You know, I sometimes hear people say that, and it
That's
was that
really interesting
for me. So it's not my primary addiction, but it was the one that enabled me to face my primary addiction because it was just so gross.
You talked about shame a lot then, and I'd just like to talk about shame a bit more.
Yeah, well, when I was in treatment, we had these sessions where we had to sit around and talk about our most, like, out of control experiences with drink and drugs. And I remember being like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to tell these strangers. And then I remember the counsellor saying, the thing is, shame dies when you expose it to the light. And it does, because also, the thing I realised that these things that I thought I was the only person doing them, I was the only, you know, mum or the only, you know, no, I wasn't. And this is what happens to people when they're in the grips of addiction. I thought I was a bad person, and I realised that I wasn't a bad person. I was just an ill person who sometimes did bad things because of that illness. Mm. And shame kept me sick, really, for a long time.
I've had a lot of conversations about shame doing this podcast and about, especially for women, it's such a tool for keeping them in their place. You know, stuff like period shame, you know, FGM, honour killings, all of that are like hinged on shame existing, aren't they? So is your main advice for dealing with shame, toxic shame, to just bring it out into the light?
Call it out, yeah. I mean, you don't have to, like, you don't have to stand up and make a public, but like, just recognize it for what it is. Because I can get moments where I feel shame over things that in conversations with people, and people won't know that that's brought that up for me. Do you know what I mean? And I have to really recognize what it is. But yeah, if someone tries to shame you, that's their shit. It's not yours.
But it's the carrying of it, isn't it? Yeah, around.
Yeah, like a kind of like a really like a sack of potatoes, dragging it around. Like, it's bad for my back.
Yeah. I recently had a conversation with I put on so much weight after I had my children, and I was talking to my husband about the shame I felt about it and how I didn't want to go to the doctors and all that kind of stuff. And just actually saying it out loud was such a relief. It's like that carrying around the potatoes. Let's not carry around potatoes, Bryony.
Do you point them? I mean, just eat them. Just eat them.
In all the ways. Three doses of carbohydrate.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories.
So let's go on to moment number four, which is asking the handsome but dull bloke I worked with if he wanted to share a cab home from the pub. Who was this dull man?
His reader, I married him. Listener, I married him. So listen, I put that in. This is really a quick one. I'm not like, I don't have it, but like, I made a lot of bad decisions in my 20s and early 30s. And it was like, there was some sort of, like, look, my life was not made better by a man, clearly, because I got married, had a kid still, you know, and then 4 years later ended up in rehab. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not a straight line, and I don't want anyone to think that. But it was part of me making a choice. Like, here was a nice man who I thought was really boring because he was nice, because he wasn't treating me like shit, do you know what I mean? My kind of idea of what I deserved was so f***ed up. And so I thought he was dull, and I thought he was really ordinary. And actually it turns out, I'm glad I asked if you wanted to share a cab back, because it turns out he was extraordinary. And I'm really glad, because, you know, like, he's my person. You know, it all kind of clicked in, and before I knew it, I was like, oh, we're sort of living together. He was like, yeah, we are, aren't we? I was like, oh. And then I was like, oh, my period's late. I was like, oh, we're going to have a kid together. Oh, well. And then all these years later, like 10 years on, I'm like, oh, we own a house together. And...
You're married.
And we're married, and we have a 7-year-old daughter, and we're discussing things like loft conversions. I'm like, all right, well, there you go.
Yeah, it's like you're starting to realise, actually, I don't need to be with someone who's going to treat me like shit. Actually, I'm worth a bit more. And then, you know, it's kind of like,
yeah.
And you're right, it's not about him making you better, it's about you starting to...
Yeah, it was like, I remember saying to this other guy, like, do you love me? I was like, I love you. And he's like, I don't love you. And I was like, oh, how can I make him love me? I'm like, what the f***, Gordon?
Oh, God, we've all been there.
I think back to those little versions of me and I'm like, oh, poor you.
There's something I was going to say to you, though, about your husband. Like, he's been incredibly supportive.
Yes.
As you've said. In your writing, and
do you want to ask me why he stays with me?
No, I wasn't.
Because I feel like that's like that's on the tip of people's tongues, and no, my answer is because I'm f-ing awesome.
I knew that, and that's why I wasn't going to ask you that. Well, no, what I was going to ask you is this: like, when you write about that last, like the last night of the bank holiday weekend in August, when that's kind of the last time you went out drinking. And when I was reading it and you were saying, I feel so terrible, I feel so much shame, you know, I should be at home with my child and instead I'm drinking. And I was thinking, if this was a man writing this, I mean, there would be so much less of that shame. I know so many men who do that so often and like they're not beating themselves up about it, like because they're not mothers. So I guess my question is, but your husband has... the flip side of that, which is like people thinking, you know, why can't you control your woman kind of thing? Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, how do you together deal with that as a couple?
We don't give a shit. We just don't give a shit. I don't think we pay much attention. We're like, it's not anyone's business. Like, we coexist very happily. And listen, Harry has never read a word I've written. He's like, you make me out to be some knight in shining armor, which is not true. And then I'm like, but I've never read a word he's written. He's a financial, I don't know what he does. He writes about like banks and things, like financial corruption in the city. And I'm like, I don't read his stuff. So we have very normal lives now. Like, his friends don't say to him, Jesus, you can't keep your wife. And, you know, like, I think they just know that Harry's Harry and I'm me. And together, somehow, we make a kind of... We make a couple. I think people were surprised when we got together at the beginning because they were like, she's mad. But, but like, they liked me. Do you know what I mean? They were like, but she's nice, but she is a bit... Like, his flatmates used to call me Santa Boozer Claus. He only told me that, like, when I got to rehab. Anyway, but no, so I don't really care what people think about me and Harry. All that matters is what I think about me and Harry, and which is that it's all good. It's all good in this hood. For the time being.
The hood of Clapham. Yes.
Yes. Mean streets of Battersea. But very boring.
Well, that's the secret, isn't it?
I'm not. No, but I mean, our lives aren't very interesting. I love it. I love my life, but it isn't like...
You can be a boring... You can have a boring life, but be an interesting person.
Totally. I'm like, Harry, you've had too many drinks. You know, people like my friends who've known me since I was a teenager, like one of my best friends, she says to me, it's so weird because even though I've seen you at your worst drinking and drugging, she's like, I can't imagine you now as that person because it's so, do you know what I mean? Like the transformation, you know, it's like Brandy doesn't drink now. That's that. And we all just get on with it, you know.
Okay, I'm going to come onto this in a minute. Let me go to moment five.
Okay. Yeah. What's moment five? Can't
moment
remember.
Five is having your daughter.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had to include that, didn't
I? Of course. But, I mean, that's pretty life-shaping, isn't it?
So yeah. I think it was weirdly. So the reason I wanted to include that was because, weirdly, a lot of people think having a child is going to be the moment their career sort of, like, starts to zone down. For me, it was the moment my career sort of took off because I just was like, I need to get serious now. I didn't take any anymore because I was like, listen, it's obviously complicated. Like, I was still in active alcoholism, but I was like hiding it. But I was like, really, like, this is the thing. You can be very high functioning and achieving lots and still be a alcoholic, you know. I signed my first book deal. I remember holding my daughter. She was like 3 weeks old or something, you know, and I wrote it by the time she was 7 months, maybe.
What?
She was a baby. I didn't do anything. I just was like, feed her. Bleh. I mean, it's not that good a book. You know, but what I mean is that I was like, right, I've got to get serious now. I've got a kid and I need to be able to pay the mortgage. So I was very high achieving. I became more high achieving once I had her than before, in a weird way.
So when was she born?
2013, the spring of 2013.
So actually, yes, looking at your, you know, your publications list, it basically all starts 2014 and then it's like bam, 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 bam after that.
But I think it's really interesting because I've only had one child and I don't think I could have been as prolific as I have been if I had more than one. Do you see what I mean? So I feel like I actually feel like I've had like seven children because it is like writing a book is like giving birth. Kind of Edie's my firstborn, and then there's The Wrong Knickers, then there's Mad Girl, then there's Eat Drink Run, then there's You Got This. Then there's Glorious Rock Bottom, and now there's, what's the next one? No Such Thing as Normal, the book about Morrissey, I've written.
Go and buy it now in all good bookshops. Yeah. Find out the truth about Morrissey.
It's not, there's no mention of Morrissey in it. Don't worry, everyone.
So that's really interesting. I mean, from my point of view, when I had my first child, I basically couldn't even think, let alone write my name down. I mean, so I'm so impressed that you managed to write a book when she was still a tiny baby.
Here's what I realise now, is that I was so insecure in myself, I couldn't stop. Like, I wasn't in a good place in my head, so I couldn't stop. So I had to carry on, do you know what I mean? And I, you know,
well, insecurity is clearly the driver of productivity for you.
Maybe, yeah. Yes, definitely.
Well, then,
once I feel that I'm I'm good enough, you won't catch me writing anything. I can't be bothered. But anyway, I just thought I'd put, obviously, because my daughter, but also because although it took me a while, she was the reason I knew I had to get sober. Do you know what I mean? And like, because I thought that having a baby would slow me down. And of course, I didn't drink while I was pregnant, or it was like I was back in the pub 2 weeks after she was born. And you know, and I always remember hearing someone in a 12-step meeting saying that they couldn't stop drinking and using for their children, and I remember bursting into tears because I had thought that would be enough, like that would be enough to get me to sort me out, like I would grow up. I just assumed I'd be like the kind of person that just had like a couple of glasses of red wine maybe a couple of nights a week, and it didn't happen. And I just was appalled with myself. Like, I just was like, how can I be that? And of course, now I know that that is a symptom of alcoholism. You know, it wasn't that I was a bad mother. It was that I was an ill one, you know, and I'm very lucky in that I had a lot of support around me. Do you know what I mean? And I managed to clean myself, but it, you know, she was four by the time I'd got myself to rehab, and it was starting to get just progressively worse, as it does. Mm. But, you know, I wonder if I didn't have her in my life, would I have just stayed out because I could, because there would be no consequences? Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Like, I really admire young people that come in, you know, like, I have friends in sobriety who are, you know, they get sober in like their 20s. And I just think, gosh, that's incredible, you know.
Mm. Yeah. So having her, you think possibly was that, gave you that extra reason?
It was the moment I realised I was probably an alcoholic.
Well, shall we go on to going to rehab? Because that's your moment six, is choosing to rehab.
I think I could talk about all the, like, the bad things that happened to me or whatever. But I want to talk about, you know, just being sober.
Yeah.
I went to rehab. I started rehab the day before my daughter started reception. And there are friends I have now that just, they can't imagine me drinking or anything. And I genuinely couldn't imagine, like, when I got to that point, I couldn't imagine, I didn't want to drink, but I didn't know how to stop. And I couldn't imagine a life without drinking. The point was that I was, like, hollowed out by self-loathing. Like, I couldn't carry on anymore. Do you know what I mean? It was just horrible. And I was like, if I don't stop, I'm going to die. I'm either going to die by drinking, by choking on my own vomit, or I'm going to die by choosing to take my own life, or I'm going to die by continuing to live in this, like, Groundhog Day existence. I think it's been the most remarkable thing, and I couldn't see any hope in being sober, but it's just the most wonderful way to live, you know. The more sober I am, the less I realise I know. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Like, there's a wondrous joy to that. Like, what don't I know now that I will find out in a year? Like, it's the most wonderful process, and I'm really grateful for it. And I'm, you know, things like talking to you now, you know, just like having a month, it's Monday, and I've got up, I've done a 12-step meeting at 6 a.m, and then I went for a run, and then, you know, but it's fine, and I'll be, you know, but my day will be done by 2:33.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that, yeah. I'm realizing now I can have a life I want to have, and that is because of sobriety, like, yeah. You know, and it's also something that I feel really proud of. I feel really proud of the fact I'm sober.
Oh, my God, you should. I mean, and 3 years now. That's a really long, like, a really long time.
Yeah, nearly 3.5, actually. And it does just get better and better. You know, I couldn't have done it by myself. I use a 12-step program, and that's incredible. I think that we are... I'm not going to say we're all on our own journey.
Go on.
But, like, when you are f***ing up, especially when you're up, you were doing some of the work to get yourself better. Does that make sense? You know,
yes.
I write a lot about this in the new book. It's like every time, you know, we've got to recalibrate how we see those moments, you know, and also have to, you know, to see that the things that we think are our flaws or our failures are actually mostly our superpowers. So, like, an example being the last year that we've just been through, you know, when this started, I was really calm. And all the people that I knew who had been through some sort of mental health crisis were also really calm, because they were like, okay, the government wants me to lock down in my house for the greater good of humanity, and everyone's going to be doing it. Like, no problemo. Like, some of the lockdowns I've been in the 3-month lockdowns in my head by myself, like, that's shit. That's hard. And it was really interesting that the people that hadn't experienced mental health crisis, my friends that had always sort of seemed to breeze through life, suddenly lost their shit, you know. And I don't, that's not a judgment. And they were like, what? How am I coming to you for advice, Bryony? Do you know what I mean? Like, but do you see what I mean? And I suddenly realised, and that was what kind of inspired this book, which was that so many of the things that I have always thought, you know, throughout my life were failures and flaws, were actually superpowers. And, you know, of course, as lockdowns have gone on, and, you know, it's not great for your mental health, but, like, I try my hardest, even when I'm in absolute, because it's all well and good, like a middle class woman going, oh, well, it may be dark, but, you know, the light is on its way. It's like, f*** off. I'm in the dark. I don't want to hear this anymore. But like, what I mean is that if you can try and kind of like hold on to the fact that like this has been a shit year, right? But like there have undoubtedly been some quite liberating things for me the last year, you know, that come from them. They're things that were painful, but they happened because of the situation. Like I was forced to confront shit like bags of potatoes that I was dragging around with me, and I had to snip them, and it was f***ing hard, do you know what I mean, and horrible, but like fuck, I'm now light and free, do you know what I mean? And similarly, that dark shit, you know, I don't think that often about my about the dark moments of my drinking, but I do sometimes, because it is reminds me of why I don't want to pick up a drink, and why I'm a f***ing awesome human being, because look how far I've come, do you know what I mean? Like wow, yeah. Like life's pretty good, you know.
I think it's incredible, and actually the way that you talk about it, it's not like every day I'm, you know, struggling. You're saying sobriety has given me such an incredible life, and I'm so happy with it.
Yeah, and some days I struggle, but like so does everyone. That's life.
Yeah. No, of course.
Like, I'm not anti-alcohol, but I'm anti us not acknowledging the effects it can have on some people. And people can drink safely, and that's, if you can, then that's like, life's too short, don't like have a drink, do you know what I mean? But if like me, and you can't just have a drink, it's like life would be, will be even shorter if you continue down that path, do you know what I mean? So
yeah. Thank you so much. Can I ask you one more question before we go? If you have to think of a pure happy moment, what do you think of? Like, if you have to get to sleep, you have to go to a happy place, what moment do you think of?
Just yesterday, like just chilling with my family, feeling safe, you know, just feeling safe. You know, I have a lot of little happy moments like that. It takes less to make you happy when you're sober, because your brain isn't used to massive dopamine hits. So it's just literally like you get happier, like look, I remember a counsellor saying to me, at some point, you know, you'll start smiling at the tweet of a bird or the smile of a child. And I was like, that sounds shit. Is that worth getting sober for? But it's true. It's true. Like I could just be walking down the street and be like, oh, isn't it a lovely foggy day today? Thank God I'm alive, you know? I'm up and out.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.